This is the fourth of a series of five lessons that I've entitled A Preface to Matthew. Now, as I explained in more detail last week, my goal in this series is to establish a framework to lay down a grid that will help you as we work verse by verse through the text of Matthew to notice things that you might otherwise have only seen. While the construction of a grid or a framework or a scaffolding is not always the most glamorous of tasks, it makes possible connections that would otherwise be altogether missed, enables you to notice things that would otherwise perhaps have simply passed you by. Given the multi-layered richness of Matthew's gospel, given the immense amount of gold that is contained in his waters, it's well worth the effort to spend some time establishing frameworks that will help us to retain just a little bit of that gold, more of that gold than we otherwise would. So let's go before the Lord in prayer and get started. Father, I come before you this evening and I just pray for your blessing on this discussion about Matthew's use of the Old Testament. And I pray, Father, Lord, you'd help give us insight, help just strengthen our minds, Father, Lord, to understand what you have for us in your word. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. In our first lesson, we dealt with the fourfold gospel. We first focused in on the writing of the fourfold gospel, then moved on to talk about the preserving of the fourfold gospel, and concluded by discussing the reading of the fourfold gospel. While there's a significant value to reading horizontally, comparing the various gospel accounts of a single story, the priority must always be on reading them vertically, that is, in the form and the order that the Spirit inspired each of them to give us the distinctive vision of the glory of Christ that each of them provide. So we talked about the fourfold gospel. And then in the second week, we talked about the structure of Matthew. In our second lesson, we turned to the structure of Matthew, working through three of the interlocking structures that Matthew uses to communicate to us the full significance of who Jesus was and is. So we first dealt with Matthew's narrative, dealing in particular with the way that he follows the basic narrative outline of Mark's gospel. And then we then turned to Matthew's discourses, the five explicitly marked blocks in which he systematically summarizes the teaching of Jesus on various topics. So we talked about Matthew's discourses, and finally we concluded with a whirlwind discussion of Matthew's symphony, or the story of Israel, in the key of Jesus. Our focus in that lesson was to point out the way in which Matthew has used a pattern of quotations from and allusions to the Old Testament to structure his gospel as a retelling of the story of Israel. In our time tonight, we'll be revisiting some of this ground from a different angle, dealing with some of the specific techniques that Matthew uses to connect the Old and the New together. So when we say Matthew's quoting the Old Testament, what are we talking about? When we say Matthew's alluding to the Old Testament, what are we talking about there? So we're going to dig into that tonight. In our third week, we talked about the goal of Matthew. So we dealt with a few different topics on that night. We talked about the writer of Matthew, what we know about the one that God used to give this gospel to us. And then we turned to the writing of Matthew, paying a particular attention to the significance of the fact that Matthew is written in Greek. And we concluded by focusing on the purpose of Matthew's gospel, dealing with the readers that Matthew anticipated, the problems that Matthew addressed, and the purpose that Matthew accomplished. Though we don't know all the details, when we give attention to the dynamics of the first century situation that's depicted in the New Testament as a whole, and we even talked about this a bit when we gave the preface to Roman before we got into our neighborhood fellowships, it becomes clear that Matthew's readers were caught between a Jewish culture that increasingly rejected the followers of Jesus and an increasingly Gentile church that sometimes faced the temptation to downplay or ignore the importance of the Old Testament altogether. And in response to this challenge, Matthew sought to equip discipled scribes with the tools that they needed to hold the new and the old together, to forge a new community by demonstrating that the true followers of Jesus could not be satisfied with either a Judaism that refused to accept the Gentiles on equal terms, or a Gentile Christianity that wanted to forget that the salvation they received was inescapably rooted in the Old Testament. And so in order to accomplish this purpose, Matthew needed to demonstrate that Jesus was the fulfillment of the Old Testament, the reality towards which the text, the figures, and the stories of the Old Testament pointed forward to. He needed to show that far from abandoning his promises to Israel, God had in Jesus faithfully brought those promises to the fruition he had intended all along. Fulfillment is by no means the same thing as replacement. On the one hand, no matter how paradoxical it seemed to the unbelieving Jews, Matthew insisted that Jesus was the goal of the story of Israel, the one in whom God's purpose for the nation from the call of Abraham was fulfilled. On the other hand, Matthew insisted with equal fervor, the churches that gathered in Jesus' name could not truly understand who Jesus was and is without immersing themselves in the story of the Old Testament, no matter how uncool that Old Testament heritage was in the broader society. The church could not jettison itself, could not disconnect itself from the Old Testament without distorting who Jesus was and who Jesus is. And given this purpose, it's no surprise to find that Matthew's gospel is literally saturated with references to the Old Testament of every kind. The Old Testament is, as I've titled this lesson, the quarry of Matthew, the source from which he derives the material he uses in his presentation of Jesus. By God's grace, over the course of our exposition of Matthew, we will see in much more detail how every page of Matthew uses the material of the Old Testament as the building blocks, as the quarry for presenting the newness that has come to us in Jesus. Tonight, however, though, we're going to focus on detailing some of the different ways in which Matthew quotes from and alludes to the Old Testament. So there should be a handout circulating that just gives a basic outline. And we're going to talk about really simple, basic stuff. Quotations from the Old Testament in Matthew and allusions to the Old Testament in Matthew. So quotations and allusions and some of the different ways that Matthew quotes and some of the different ways that Matthew alludes to the Old Testament. While the exact tally depends on how one does the counting, there are somewhere around 60 direct quotations from the Old Testament in Matthew's Gospel. And depending on how your New Testament is arranged, in most English editions of the Bible, at least, that's more than one per page. We'll discuss three different kinds of quotation, three ways that Matthew quotes from the Old Testament, before moving on to discuss the matter of allusions. So we have marked quotations of a single Old Testament passage. We have marked quotations that combine multiple Old Testament passages. And we have unmarked quotations. And we'll dig in. Basically, a marked quotation is where Matthew says, this is what the prophet said, or as it is found in the book of Psalms, or something like that, where Matthew is pointing out, this, what I'm about to say, is a quotation. He's sort of putting quote marks around it, as it were. An unmarked quotation is where he doesn't indicate it comes from the Old Testament, but it's still a quotation. Before we dig in, it's important to point out that if you use an English Bible, and you compare a New Testament quotation of the Old Testament with the Old Testament passage that's being quoted, you will find that the wording will almost never match exactly. And sometimes it will seem very different. There are a number of reasons for this. Sometimes the variation is simply at the level of English translation. As I mentioned last time, the King James in particular will often translate the same phrase, same Greek phrase, different ways in the same book. And that becomes a much bigger issue if you're going from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Often very similar phrases or the same phrases will be translated in considerably different ways. Yet there are other reasons for these differences. Sometimes, very often in fact, as we've already mentioned, the New Testament quotations will be following one of the Old Greek translations of the Old Testament rather than quoting directly from the Hebrew. However, there is a twist here, because as it turns out, there were actually a number of different translations and revisions of translations of the Greek Old Testament in the first century. Working with multiple translations is not a 21st century thing. It was already an issue in, or not an issue, but it was already a reality in the first century. But the twist is that all of the Greek translations of the Old Testament that were extant in the first century aren't extant in the 21st century. So determining whether or not the New Testament writer is exactly the details, you can tell how that becomes very complicated very quickly, and most of you will be thankful to know we're not going to explore that any further tonight. However, it's something to be aware of, and it's a really technical thing you can geek out on if you want to. At other times, it becomes obvious that the New Testament writers have intentionally made small changes to the Old Testament quotation, either simply to abbreviate it or to shape it in a new grammatical and historical context, moving from looking forward to an event to looking back on it, so things like that, or even to draw out the intended meaning of the verses more emphatically. So there will also be intentional alterations that will, for those reasons. Well, given the amount of time that we have and the innate complexity of some of these issues, most of you will be thankful to learn we won't attempt to work through all these factors in each of the passages that we mention. However, they are helpful to keep in mind, both in the discussion that follows and in your own personal study. If you're wondering, why doesn't it line up exactly? It's going to be one of these reasons or something similar to that. So there's a lot of answers, potential answers to that. Any questions on that? Any questions on what we just covered up to this point? Philemon. That often is the debate in some cases, you know, because you also have, you know, not all the translations are of the whole Old Testament. So you have different, you know, so really what it comes down to often, the question is it a revision that the author of the book is making? So are they working from the Hebrew text and revising a Greek translation, or did they already have that available to them? So that really is where it comes down to. And so then because you have all the other factors that could also be playing, it gets to be, you know, kind of a, it's sometimes difficult to be certain. Like many, many, many dissertations have been written on those sorts of things. So anyone else? All right. A marked quotation, as I already mentioned, is one where Matthew explicitly points out to his readers that the words that follow are a quotation from the Old Testament. As one example, take Matthew 1:22-23, the first direct quotation in the Gospel. Now, all this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, "Behold, a virgin shall be with child and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which is being interpreted, "God with us." So who's the prophet Matthew's talking about? Anyone? Isaiah. Isaiah is the prophet. And in the quotation found in the first part of verse 23, "Behold, a virgin shall be with child and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," the Greek text of Matthew almost exactly follows the old Greek translation of Isaiah 7:14 with only one minor difference. So Matthew says, I'm quoting the prophet. You can go back to the Greek text of Isaiah and you can locate his quotation exactly right there. Without, at this point, going into the tremendous depths of meaning in Matthew's use of Isaiah at this point, we'll get to that in a few weeks in our study of Matthew, or exploring all the theological implications of this meaning, considered simply as a quotation, it's a pretty straightforward example. Matthew says, here's a quotation from the Old Testament that this is the fulfillment of that. He quotes that. It's a quote. You can look it up. Pretty straightforward. Matthew has directly quoted a single verse from a single passage in the Old Testament and explicitly told his readers that he was doing so. Any questions on that? Okay. At other points in his gospel, Matthew will deliberately weave together multiple passages from the Old Testament into a single quotation. We find a striking example of this in Matthew chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. While in the narrative context of Matthew, the scribes of Jerusalem are the ones telling Herod that the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem, The Old Testament quotation itself is undoubtedly the work of Matthew. So Matthew 2, 5, and 6, "And they said unto him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel." Matthew has in this case intentionally modified some of the wording, something we'll discuss in more detail when we come to this passage in our verse-by-verse exposition of Matthew. The first part of this quotation, "And thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor," clearly comes from one of the Old Testament prophets. Does anyone know what Old Testament prophet that is? That talks about a ruler coming out of Bethlehem. Micah, that's right. It comes from Micah 5:2. And yet Matthew 2:6 is more than a simple quotation of Micah 5:2. Because the last clause, "that shall rule," and the Greek word is pimeno, which refers explicitly to shepherding, "that shall shepherd, that shall rule my people Israel," doesn't come from Micah 5:2. In fact, it doesn't come from Micah at all. It comes from a different passage entirely. "That shall shepherd my people Israel." What Old Testament, without the book or the reference, who is the shepherd of my people Israel in the Old Testament? Petey? Jesus? Right, this is about Jesus, but who is the one who's the shepherd in the Old Testament? David. David is the shepherd. Though Moses was a shepherd too, Petey. That's true. And that's actually, there's these multiple connections where the fact that David is taken from the flock to lead the people of Israel is specifically comparing him to Moses, who was taken from the flock to lead the people of Israel. And so the very story of David is told in a way that reminds you of the story of Moses, because Moses is sort of the prototypical guide of... Anyway, we can get into that, but back to what we're talking about tonight. Though Matthew has not pointed it out for us, this last phrase is taken from 2 Samuel 5:2. "Then came all the tribes of Israel to David and to Hebron and spake, saying, Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, thou wast he that leddest out and broughtest in Israel. And the Lord said to thee, Thou shalt feed," in the Greek Old Testament, it's again, pimano, the same word Matthew uses to shepherd. "Thou shalt shepherd my people Israel, and thou shalt be a captain over Israel." So the last part of Matthew's quotation from Micah, he has stuck in this clause that comes from 2 Samuel. In other words, in the course of a single citation, a single sentence in Matthew's text, he has woven together quotations from multiple Old Testament passages, indeed from multiple Old Testament books, into one continuous whole. And this sort of composite quotation of weaving together different passages is something that Matthew does repeatedly. And there's a reason for this. Matthew's overriding purpose, as we focused on last week, was to teach his readers how to fit the old and the new together. But in order to teach them how to fit the old and the new together, he had to teach them how to fit the old and the old together first. And central to this purpose was the task of teaching them how to read the Old Testament. What passages should they read in the light of which other passages, and how should they read all of those passages in the light of Jesus Christ? By weaving together snippets from multiple passages into a single quotation, Matthew is teaching his readers to read those passages together. Those who weren't familiar enough with the Old Testament to notice what he was doing would still be able to pick up on Matthew's basic point, that the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem was a fulfillment of prophecy without difficulty. Yet for the reader either skilled enough in the Old Testament to notice what he is doing, or diligent enough to track it down, Matthew is doing something quite astonishing. As Patrick Shiner put it in his excellent book on Matthew's Gospel, the surface meaning of the text is plain, but for those who have eyes to see, extra gems reveal that the child born in Bethlehem is the ruler in the line of King David. And of course, the passage in 2 Samuel is dealing with the amount of connections, if you know the passage in 2 Samuel and you know the situation with Herod and the way that Jesus is being explicitly portrayed as the rightful king against the usurper who's taken over the throne. There's a lot of things. If you know the story well enough to pick up on what Matthew's doing, you're getting 3 and 4 extra layers of meaning that we could spend the whole night just unpacking. This one weaving together of Scripture and the significance and the implication of that within what's taking place in Matthew chapter 2 of the Gospel. Any questions about all of this, what we just went over, in terms of weaving together multiple passages? Anyone? Well, we'll move on then. So let's move on to unmarked direct quotations. At other times, Matthew will include a fairly direct quotation without explicitly mentioning that it comes from the Old Testament. So a good example of this is found in Matthew 10:34-36, found in the second topical discourse, which focuses on discipleship. Jesus is speaking, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I am come not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household." And while there is some slight variation in the wording, this is a fairly direct quotation of Micah 7:6. Once again, while the passage makes sense by itself, understanding the context of these words in the Old Testament adds depth and richness to the point that is being made, because what he's talking about is the messianic sorrows, the division that precedes the setting up of the messianic kingdom. If you're familiar with the context in Micah, that's really what Jesus is alluding to here, and what we're finding in Matthew's gospel as it's been arranged in this particular way. Now, there's a really kind of complicated word that refers to something that's very important when you're considering the way the New Testament writers are using the Old Testament. And that word is metalepsis. Now, that sounds like maybe some bizarre thing that might happen to a butterfly. But here's what it refers to. It's when you give a quote from something, but you're intending to refer not just to the part that you're quoting, but you're intending for the alert readers to have in mind what comes before and after. You're intending them to think of the whole chapter, the whole overall context in the Old Testament. So an example of this is often, how many of you have heard when someone will do a medley? Well, Brother Don, when you put together your medley of old-fashioned hymns, right? And you put together these snippets of songs, but you intended, in writing that song, for people to think and to resonate with the whole song, and because they're familiar songs, then you've got a whole depth of emotional experience in listening to that, because you're bringing into this new song not just the words themselves of the song, but you're bringing the emotional connections that you have with each of those songs and the message that's made by each of those songs, and you're deliberately intending to make people think of that. Is that right? Pardon? Yes. Good. I didn't clear that one with you beforehand, so I'm glad that I wasn't too wrong on that. But the same thing that you did with that song is what Matthew will do with the Old Testament, that he's writing for people who are intensely familiar with the Old Testament, and they know these passages and they know these stories. So when Matthew puts this story and this story together, it's like a revelation, because people have in mind, they already know what is going on in these passages. And when he says, "I want you to think of this passage in this context," well, they're aware of the context of that passage in the Old Testament. And he's teaching them to read that whole passage. He's teaching them to think of that whole context and to hold these things together. And so we're going to definitely be exploring some of that as we go through the Old Testament, as we go through Matthew's gospel and the way he uses the Old Testament. But if we go through it in sort of bite-sized chunks, it should turn out to be manageable. Any questions about any of that before we move on? All right, let's move on to allusions. While there are roughly 5 dozen quotations from the Old Testament in Matthew, there are well over 300, and really, There's no way of calculating exactly how many there are. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of additional allusions to texts, individuals, and stories from the Old Testament. When we think of this matter of allusions, and I already sort of got ahead of myself a little bit here, it's helpful to think of a name that note competition. Have any of you ever seen one of those? No? Do you know what I'm talking about? So here's how they work. In these competitions, contestants will compete for how quickly they can identify the source of just a few notes. And so they'll play, you know, a bar of a song, and they'll say, I know that song, I know what it is. I know that song, I know what it is. And some of them will be wrong, and they'll eliminate, and they'll move more and more till they go to more obscure songs. They're playing briefer and briefer sections of more and more obscure songs until there's only one person that's left standing. So the more well-known the song, the more distinctive its tune is, and the more notes of that tune are played, the easier it is to identify, and the more certain the contestants can be that they've correctly identified it. The less well-known the song, the less distinctive the tune, and the fewer notes are played, the harder it is to identify it, and eventually you get to the point where there's only one person left, and no one can identify anything further. So you get down and down and down till people can't recognize the allusions anymore. As the songs become more obscure, the tunes become less distinctive, and the notes become fewer, it becomes harder and harder to correctly identify the song for all but the most eagle-eared of listeners. And this is almost exactly the way that Matthew's allusions to the Old Testament work. Many of his allusions are very obvious references to well-known passages or stories in the Old Testament that contain very distinctive notes and that are enough notes to easily recognize it. So some of the allusions are such that only the most tone-deaf of his readers that are familiar with the Old Testament could miss them. At the other extreme, some allusions are so brief and so subtle that even very attentive readers can disagree as to whether or not an allusion was intended at all. So the more well-known the passage is, the more distinctive it is, and the more strikingly Matthew alludes to it, the more words he used to allude to it, the easier it is to know there's a clear allusion here. On the other end of the spectrum, the less well-known the passage is, the briefer the allusion, and the less distinctive the wording is, the more debatable it becomes. So you have a spectrum. So with quotations, it's usually pretty easy to identify, hey, he's quoting from this passage, or maybe from this passage and this passage. Even if he doesn't tell you it's a quotation, you can compare the text, you can figure it out. With an allusion, he's asking the readers to do a little bit more work. But he's doing this same thing, where he's wanting to strike these tones that remind you, that make connections, that sort of spark these neural connections of how to read the old in the light of the new. And so we're going to discuss relatively clear allusions tonight, since I had my pick of examples. I picked ones that were more obvious than not. So we'll discuss an allusion to an Old Testament text, an Old Testament figure, and an Old Testament story. Now, of course, the figures and the stories are also found in the text. So this is a little bit of an artificial distinctive, but I think you'll get what I mean by it. So let's start with an allusion to a text. The first two words of Matthew contain an allusion that is very obvious and very striking and very important for understanding the fullness of Matthew's point. We're going to talk about this in more detail next Sunday morning, Lord willing. Matthew 1:1 reads like this: "The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." In Greek, the book of the generation is Biblos Genesios, the book of the Genesis, which are the exact Greek words that are found as a heading in Genesis 5:1. In fact, it's the exact Greek word from which we get our English word Genesis. It's the book of the Genesis. These words are very distinctive. So the entirety of the Greek Old Testament, there are only two verses where these two words appear together, and only one of these verses has an underlying phrase in Hebrew that matches it, and that verse is Genesis 5:1. So there's only one place in the Old Testament where these two words appear together. That's Genesis 5:1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man in the likeness of God, made he him. And by means of this strong and striking allusion, Matthew is making the point that the coming of Jesus represents a new start for the people of God, a new Genesis, as it were. By God's grace, as we start our series on Matthew next week, we'll deal with all of this, what all of this means in much more detail. So it's just two words. It's not enough to be a quotation, but those two words are distinctive enough and well known enough that the allusion is nonetheless unmistakable. So it's just two words. It's not a long quotation of a whole passage, but they're distinctive enough and well known enough that it's easy to see what Matthew is doing. Any questions on that? Okay. Allusions to a figure. As we discussed a few weeks ago when we talked about the structure of Matthew, other allusions focus not so much on a particular text as on a particular figure in the Old Testament. Though, of course, there's a lot of overlap, as I already mentioned, between text and figures. At the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, the first of Matthew's five discourses, we find these words. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, when you hear went up into a mountain, what do you think of in the Old Testament? Who is it that goes up into a mountain? Moses. I mentioned it briefly a few weeks ago. Went up into a mountain translates the Greek phrase, anevi eis to oras. This exact phrase occurs only three times in the entirety of the Greek Old Testament. All three of those occurrences are in Exodus, and all three of them refer to Moses going up to the mountain to receive the law from God. The allusion is unmistakably intentional. It's not just, oh, Moses went up into a mountain, Jesus went up into a mountain. Matthew uses the exact same phrase that's used to describe Moses as going up into a mountain to underscore and sort of put a sharpie, you know, exclamation point beside the text. Jesus is doing something that Moses did. And yet, as always, there's even more here. You see, Moses didn't go up the mountain to give the law of God. He went up to the mountain to receive the law from God. In other words, Jesus is drawing together both the role of Moses, the faithful servant of God who went up the mountain, and the role of the Lord God himself who gave his law from the mountain. He's drawing together what the human part of the covenant relationship was supposed to do and God's part of the covenant relationship and doing both of them himself, which of course is kind of the point of the incarnation. We could easily spend all night digging into this, and we'll return to it whenever we get to Matthew 5. We dig into everything, it may be a while, but when we get there, we'll return to this. But are there any questions to that before we move on? Questions? Other allusions focus not so much on particular individuals, but on particular sequences of events, particular stories. As I mentioned earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, the first discourse found in Matthew chapter 5 through 7, Matthew directly alludes to the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. It is no accident that he places this discourse directly after he's related a journey from Egypt, followed by a passage through water, followed by testing in the wilderness. There's a narrative sequence that directly is parallel to the narrative sequence found in the Old Testament. Matthew, as we discussed in more detail a few weeks ago, is telling the story of Israel in the key of Jesus, teaching his readers to see how everything in the Old Testament, every prophecy, every individual, every story, finds its fulfillment in Jesus, the one in whom all the promises of God find their yes and amen. We began by discussing Matthew's quotations from the Old Testament, of which there are around 60, and we dealt in turn with Mark's quotations of a single passage, Mark's quotations that combine multiple passages, and quotations that are not marked at all. We then turn to discuss just a handful of the hundreds upon hundreds of allusions to the Old Testament that we find in Matthew, focusing on allusions to specific texts, allusions to specific figures, and allusions to specific narrative sequences. As we established at the beginning, through the course of Matthew's Gospel, the Old Testament forms the quarry from which Matthew draws the material he uses to present his portrait of Jesus. By the way he uses the Old Testament, Matthew teaches his readers, teaches us, how to read the Old Testament in the light of Jesus and how to understand Jesus in the light of the Old Testament. Above all, he teaches us how to hold the old and the new together. And if we listen to his teaching and follow his example, we can begin to become, like Matthew, the sort of discipled scribes that his gospel was written to produce. As I mentioned last time, Matthew 13:52 is perhaps the verse that best sums up Matthew's central purpose in his gospel. Then said he unto them, therefore every scribe which is instructed, in Greek this is mathetes, a verbal form of the noun we translate as disciple. It literally means every discipled scribe. Unto the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which bringeth forth out of his treasure things new and old. My prayer for us all is that as we work through the text of Matthew on Sunday mornings, we'll be enabled by the Spirit to give just the sort of patient and repeated attention to the text that Matthew intended his first readers to give, so that in the end, we will ourselves be enabled to become discipled scribes, bringing forth out of our treasures things both new and old. Any final questions or comments before we wrap up? Going once, going twice. All right. Well, the last lesson in this series will be the textual transmission of Matthew. And so we'll be talking about textual variants, what they mean, what they don't mean, and how they arise. So we'll talk about that, Lord willing, next Sunday night. And then, Lord willing, next Sunday morning, we'll be starting our series on Matthew with Matthew 1:1. So I'm excited about that, to be able to have some of the fruit. We've laid some of this framework in this series. Now we're going to start getting to the meat. So with that being said, let us be dismissed.